Okay, good evening, and welcome to part three of our series of speaking Lashon Hara. And in a sense, we're a little bit going backwards, because tonight's topic really could have been the introduction. I'm just going to speak a little bit more generally about some of the philosophy and some of the principles of Lashon Hara, having first dealt with specifics such as dating and the internet environment. Tonight we'll try to go back to the basics and try to get an understanding of some of the concepts and of the framework. And as much as it seems like that's a roundabout path, but it's particularly relevant for us this week, as we've been going throughout the 3 weeks, but now here we are in the 9 days, still hoping that we can avert the fast before Sunday. So this is our last-ditch effort to try to reorient our perspective. As we mentioned, the Chafetz Chaim writes that when the Gemara says that the Beis HaMikdash, the second Beis HaMikdash, was destroyed because of Sinas Chinam means Lashon Hara. The Lashon Hara and Sinas Chinam are connected and go one after the other. And therefore, we can consider this to be essentially the key topic that we need to work on and that we hope we can turn around before we have to have another fast. So to try to give a little bit of a framework to understand what Lashon Hara is about, we know that there is a relationship between not only Lashon Hara and the Churban, but also our whole exile was traced back to the Chet HaMeraglim, the spies who gave their reports on Tisha B'Av and who spoke badly about the land. And the Gemara tells us that when the people cried in response to that bad report, God declared, Atem b'chisa and b'chia shalchinam, that you cried a cry for nothing. I will establish that it's going to be a crying that's going to last the generations. And that's our tradition, that day, the 9th of Av, all that time ago, became a Yom HaMucham L'Peranius, a day that has in its very nature this negativity, this disaster and tragedy wrapped in. And it all traces back to that sin of the Meraglim. The sin of the Meraglim is termed Dibas Haaretz, speaking badly about the land of Israel. And we understand that Dibas Haaretz essentially is an aspect of Lashon Hara. They're both two different halves of this prohibition of speaking badly, speaking negatively in an unwarranted way, whether we speak about people or we speak about the land of Israel. And the connection is highlighted by a comment that Rashi has in the beginning of Parsha Shlach, where the story of the Meraglim appears, the beginning of Parsha Shlach. Rashi has a comment there which is a little hard to understand. Rashi is quoting from Chazal, but what he says there is a little baffling. Rashi tells us, why is it that story of the spies, Parsha Shlach, is placed in the Torah immediately after Baal Oscha? So the very end of Parsha's Baal Oscha, that's the story of Miriam. Miriam speaking Lashon Hara about her brother Moshe and being punished for it with Saras. That's the last thing you read about in Baal Oscha. And then the first thing you read about in Shlach is the story of the spies. So asks Rashi, why is it that you have that juxtaposition there? Why is the Torah giving us the story of the spies immediately after the sin of Miriam? To make a point that here Miriam spoke Lashon Hara about her brother Moshe, and she got punished. And the Meraglim, says Rashi, Rishayim halalu, these evildoers, Hayilehem likach moser, they should have learned the lesson from Miriam. And the fact that they go and speak badly about the land, they engage in divas haaretz, they miss the whole point, they should have learned the lesson from Miriam. So the problem is, it's a little confusing. Because it sounds like the language, it sounds as if that's what you call a kal v'chomer. That you think that was bad, this is really bad. So it sounds like what Miriam did, that was bad. And what the spies did, that was worse. And that's difficult, because as holy as the land is, and as much as we love the land, but the land is not a human being with feelings and emotions. And to speak about a person, to speak about Moshe Rabbeinu, that would seem to be worse than speaking about the land. So the Kal Vachomer, as if to say, oh, what Miriam did, spoke about Moshe, that was bad. The Meraglim, for sure, that was bad, that they spoke about the land. Doesn't seem like that flows. I would think that what Miriam did was worse. And you don't have to take my word for it. The Gemara says that. The Gemara says it exactly like that, the opposite direction. The Gemara in Erchin, which has the greatest concentration there of Gemaras about Lashon Hara. The Gemara says, how do you know how bad it is to speak against people? Look at the Meraglim. They spoke about sticks and stones. That's the language of the Gemara, about Eitzim V'Avanim. If you're going to speak about that and get in trouble, if you would speak about a person, all the more so, for sure you're going to get in trouble. So that's what we would have thought. That Gemara, that's how we would have understood it, that to speak about people is worse than speaking about land, as holy as the land is. So why is this Rashi going in the opposite direction? Why is Rashi saying, oh, the Meraglim, they should have learned the lesson from Miriam. If she got in trouble, they for sure get in trouble. So let's keep that question in mind. And we'll try to come back to it. But that's going to begin our focus on just trying to understand what exactly Lashon Hara is. It's about time. After 3 weeks, we should finally try to understand what it is. And the truth is, it's not so clear. There are at least two ways one can conceptualize Lashon Hara. On the one hand, you could say that this is what you would call an Isser Midos, that this is a prohibition of character. That here, the Torah is telling us not just what to do and not to do, the Torah is telling us who to be. That we should not be a gossip. Lo Selech Rachil B'Amecha is the most likely candidate for the prohibition of Lashon Hara, the pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim. You should not travel around as a talebearer. Don't be that kind of person. That's what it sounds like. It's addressing our character. It's addressing our midos. Maybe that's the nature of the prohibition of Lashon Hara. Don't be someone who indulges in gossip, who likes all the dirt. That's one way to look at it. Others wouldn't necessarily see it that way. And it's a broader question whether the Torah ever actually addresses midos directly. Clearly, the Torah cares about our midos. Our whole life, as the Vilna Gaon understood, our whole life is to perfect our midos. That's what we're here for. But it could be that the Torah doesn't address midos directly because, like we said, it takes a lifetime to acquire a midah. It's not something you turn on and turn off. So the Torah addresses actions, tells you what you can do and what you can't do and what you must do, but not who to be. That is a lifetime of effort that comes from your actions. So if that's the case, how would we conceptualize Lashon Hara? It could be that Lashon Hara is about doing an action of damage to someone else. That by speaking badly about another, you are putting them at risk of harm. And we should emphasize, especially after what we talked about the past few weeks, really what we mean is you're putting them at risk of unjustified harm, of undeserved harm. We're not talking at all about somebody who's a danger and you're identifying them as a danger and saving people from that risk. We mean the very likely possibility that you're saying something that's unimportant but could cause problems for the person you're speaking about. So perhaps that's the nature, that you're not allowed to harm people by speaking about them in an unjustly negative way. And in doing so, expose them to the possibility of unwarranted harm. There's a category like that in halacha, which may fit. We know there's a prohibition to harm someone and to damage somebody's property, let's say. And there's also a prohibition that connects to that we call grama benezikin, that if you cause someone, not actually harm someone directly, but you cause somebody to be damaged, you cause their property to be damaged, so it's indirect, you're not necessarily going to be liable in court, they can't necessarily take you to Beis Din and make you pay, but there's a prohibition to set up a situation that will cause someone else to go through harm, personal or material, or otherwise. So perhaps that's the category here. It's what we call grama b'nezikin, and lashon hara is prohibited because of that. So far, so good. Makes sense? So these two possibilities. What difference does it make whether we characterize it one way, we characterize it another way? Does it matter? Probably matters. It probably affects a number of areas in the laws of lashon hara, and we'll try to briefly go through them in the time that we have, and some of them are topics that we touched upon a little bit in the past few weeks. So let's see if we can get a little bit of an overview of how the details of lashon hara might flow from these conceptualizations. So the first, we spoke about most over the past 2 weeks. We know that there is also a concept of lashon hara l'toelas, right, that we discussed especially 2 weeks ago, that sometimes you're not allowed to say something, but just as often you're obligated to say something. If the person is dangerous, if there's some kind of a risk, so then you are required to warn somebody who is subject to that risk. And that's what we call lashon hara l'toelas. That's what we call purposeful speech. And in that case, it is permitted and often required. So how do we conceptualize that? How do we understand that idea? That here, something that you're normally prohibited to say, all of a sudden becomes an obligation. How does that work? So we could explain it two ways. We could say it's because lashon hara is about the midah, it's about the attribute of being a gossip. And when it's purposeful, it simply doesn't fit the definition. What does the word gossip mean? Gossip very well might be the best English word, if you had to pick one, might be the best English word to use for lashon hara. So what does gossip connote? Gossip connotes something that's negative, but also, by its very nature, trivial and unimportant. So one could argue that the definition of lashon hara is gossip, essentially. It is, by its nature, unimportant. And if what you're saying is important, is there to make a difference, to help someone, so then, by definition, it's not gossip. It's simply not lashon hara. As someone was arguing here a few weeks ago, we talked about back and forth. We said, is lashon hara l'toelas, is that called lashon hara, or is that called not lashon hara? So you could say like that, it's not lashon hara. It's simply out of the category. Or you could formulate it a different way. If we take the second possibility, so then it's a little bit more complex. Then lashon hara is defined as harming someone or exposing someone to harm. So if I'm speaking lashon hara l'toelas, so let's say I'm telling somebody who's considering a date that this person is dangerous, or I tell someone who's considering going into a business deal with a partner, and I know this person is dishonest, is going to steal all his money. So if I tell whoever I'm talking to, don't date this guy, don't hire this person as your business partner, am I hurting the person I'm talking about? Yeah, for sure. He's going to lose out on the shidduch, he's going to lose out on the business deal. So why is it okay and required? Because there's a competing value, because there's something else that's more important right now, and that is protecting the innocent. And that is also a Torah mandate. That's also a Torah obligation. Because we are instructed, lo samod al dam reyecha. We're not allowed to stand idly by when somebody is at risk. And as the Rambam explains in Sefer HaMitzvos, al dam reyecha, it sounds like it means somebody's at risk of being killed. But as the Rambam explains, it doesn't have to be that extreme. But if somebody is at risk of any kind of harm, material, physical, spiritual, of any level, so then we're obligated to do what we can to save them from that harm. So it could be that we just have a clash here, that yes, what I'm saying is lashon hara, but I have an overriding principle. I have a mandate to protect the innocent, and that outweighs the prohibition of lashon hara. So that's what I have to pay attention to more, even though it is lashon hara. So far, so good? Makes sense? So we have these two ways to conceptualize toelas, which flows from the two ways that we can conceptualize Lashon Hara in the first place. Now, what difference does that make? So we'll theorize about it one way or another way. Does it matter? Probably matters a lot, because the question of how do you assess what is considered the toelas? How do you go through the process of deciding what to say and what not to say? So that might be very much affected by which model you use. Because according to the first model, Lashon Hara is gossip, and if you're doing something productive, it's not gossip. So then the threshold might be very low, as long as your intention is something beneficial. And it may not even have to go so far as to stopping a predator. It might just be something that helps improve a situation that's already okay but could be better. That might also not be gossip. So if that's the case, if that's the perspective, the threshold could be very low. And indeed, that's how the Chazon Ish understood it, that the question of how do you figure out if what you're saying is the toelas or not, it's basically one question to ask. Is it purposeful? If it's purposeful, it's the toelas, and that's the whole process. While if you're working off of the second understanding, that actually what you're saying is Lashon Hara, but you have to worry more about Lo Samar Al Dam Re'echa, about protecting the vulnerable, so then it's more of a rigorous process, because we're really looking to permit here a genuine prohibition, a real act of harm. So we have to carefully assess, is it warranted or not? And that's why there were those who were at the opposite end of the spectrum and had a more intense process. So for example, the Chafetz Chaim in his Sefer, he has a whole checklist of questions. Between 5 and 7 questions, it has different ways in different places, but between 5 and 7 questions that one has to address before deciding that this is justified. So that question of how rigorous the process is goes back to our initial question. Are we dealing here with a midos issue, which perhaps can be addressed in a pretty straightforward way? Or are we dealing here with overriding a prohibition, a significant prohibition, and that's going to require a lot more of a process and really carefully analyzing that the prohibition is actually not relevant? So this was a debate, practically, what kind of a process it is. We mentioned the Chazon Ish one question and the Chafetz Chaim 5 or 7 questions. And there are many who were somewhere in the middle and had 3 questions focusing on truth and purpose and scope. Just to give one example of someone who was in the middle, there is a sefer called Afikayam. Afikayam was written by Rabbi Chil Rabinovich, who was a contemporary of Rabbi Chaim Brisker. And he has a fascinating discussion where he looks carefully at the psukim in the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev. And he derives that there are 3 prohibitions, there are 3 standards, there are 3 rules you have to look at in order to know if the Lashon Hara is justified or not. Why in the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev? Because that's where we read about Yosef. And what's the first thing the Torah tells us about Yosef after he was born? What's the first thing in the beginning of Vayeshev the Torah tells us about Yosef? That he spoke Divas Ra, that he spoke Lashon Hara about his brother. Pretty surprising. That's the first thing we should hear about Yosef. And the Afikayam assumes that this must have been Lashon Hara L'Toelas. This must have been justified, purposeful Lashon Hara. And that was actually a debate. There were some who weren't so sure. There were some who thought actually this was not justified Lashon Hara. Maybe that's why Yosef ended up having problems. Sounds like that from Rashi and even from the Chafetz Chaim, the Shmiras HaLashon. There are many who are critical of Yosef. But others assume, like the Afikayam, this must have been justified Lashon Hara L'Toelas. Because after all, what was Yosef's last name? Hatzadik, right? So if his name was Hatzadik, so chances are it was probably justified. So says the Afikayam, if you look carefully at the Psukim in the beginning of Vayeshev, you can find 3 rules that emerge from the Psukim. What are the 3 rules? It says, first of all, you could ask, what was going on? What kind of Toelus is this? And it's actually interesting because it's a different model of Toelus. We've talked about Toelus till now as, let's say, warning somebody who might be a victim of a person. So telling people, so-and-so is dangerous, so-and-so is dishonest. However, this is a different model because this is about the assumption the brothers had, or the assumption that Yosef had, that the brothers were misbehaving, whether he was right or wrong, that they were doing things that were improper. And one type of Lashon Hara L'Toelus here is going to an authority figure in order to correct the behavior of those who are acting improperly. So he went to Yaakov to tell him about what the brothers were doing. That's what the pasuk says. So you could ask, why did he have to do that? Why didn't he just speak to them directly? Why didn't he just tell them that they were misbehaving? Why did he have to tell on them? It says the Afikayam, the answer is in the pasuk. Pasuk says, "V'hunar espenei bilo v'espenei zolpa," that he was a child in their eyes. Essentially, he was a brat. They're not going to listen to what he has to say. They're not going to take any messages from him. So he had no choice. He had to go straight to the father. So says the Afikayam, here's rule number one, that it has to be, there's no other way. That you can't stop this in a less harmful fashion. The only way to address it is to go to a third party. And that's what we're being taught here, that there wasn't another way to deal with it. They wouldn't listen to him. So that's why he had to go to Yaakov. That's rule number one. It's absolutely necessary. There's no other way around it. Rule number two, the language is also a little bit unusual. Vayave Yosef es dibas samra, and Yosef brought the bad reports. So you might say it's an unusual choice of words for speaking. There's so many words in Hebrew that connote speaking. So vayave means he carried, he brought the bad reports. Why does he use that kind of language? It says the Afikayam, the imagery is supposed to be, if I pick up the box of tissues and I put it over there, it's the same box of tissues when I pick it up and when I put it down. When I bring it somewhere else, it's the same item. So too, the Torah is trying to convey here that it was purely the facts. When he brought these reports to Yaakov, it was as if he was carrying an object. It was the exact same when he picked it up and when he put it down. There was no spin, there was no editorializing, nothing was added or taken away. Everything was purely factual. And that, he says, is rule number two. Everything just has to be what is. No opinions, no editorials, just the facts. That's rule number two. Rule number three, says the Afikayam, takes us into one of the more controversial rules, as we'll see. This is another interesting word choice. He brought the bad reports to their father. That's a little strange, right? Because if you were arguing with your brother, let's say, so what do you say? I'm going to tell your father on you? You say, I'm going to tell daddy. I'm going to tell Abba. You don't say your father. Wasn't Yaakov also Yosef's father? So why doesn't it say El Aviv? What's Avihem? It says the Afikayam, the Torah is telling us Avihem, in order to highlight that Yosef brought this report, not thinking at all about the fact that Yaakov was his father too, and that he could score some extra points as the favorite child by bringing this bad report. That was not at all a part of the consideration. The only reason he was talking to Yaakov is because he was the father of the boys. The fact that he was also his own father wasn't a part of the consideration. So says the Afikayam, that's the third rule, that it has to be your motives are completely pure. There's no ulterior motivation here at all. And that was actually one of the Chafetz Chaim's rules also. Happens to be it's the most controversial of the Chafetz Chaim's rules. Why is it so controversial? Because to insist on purity of motive could be dangerous. If we're going to say that you're obligated to warn a potential victim of danger, but you can't do it if you also have some history with this person, if you have some reason that there's a side benefit to you in speaking badly about this individual, so what if you're the only person who can warn of the danger? You're going to let the danger happen because your motives aren't pure enough? That doesn't sound very safe. So many objected to this. And they said it's similar to saying, let's say somebody is sick on Yom Kippur. So he needs to eat if he's sick. So should we say, okay, he's only allowed to eat on Yom Kippur to keep his health up if he hates the food. But if he also likes the food, then he's not allowed to save his life by eating. We wouldn't say that. We'd say if you need to protect yourself, we can't worry about your motives. So too here, if you need to protect the vulnerable, so how could we say that your motives have to be pure? This was actually hotly debated. There's an entire book you can find in the YU library, if I ever return it, that has a whole defense. The whole volume is defending the Chafetz Chaim on this point, because it was actually quite a debated point. And the truth is, you can understand a little bit both sides, just without reading the whole Sefer, but just briefly. So on the one hand, yes, it seems surprising that we should focus so heavily on motive when there might be a risk present. But what the Chafetz Chaim was presumably tapping into, it's not just about your own saintliness, but it's also about the concern that the assessment here is going to be tainted. If you have an ulterior motive against somebody, you have some kind of a negative history with a person, and now you're also deciding whether it's crucial to tell everyone else about how dangerous he is. So that judgment is going to be affected by that history. So presumably what the Chafetz Chaim is really telling us is to focus on that fact, to be aware that the judgment may be impacted. And ideally, if there was another person who could be the messenger here, they may be a better messenger. But if there isn't, so then presumably you're still going to have to speak up. And there was a great Talmid Chacham passed away a few years ago. His name was Rav Shraya Deblitzky, who was known actually for his punctilious observance of Hilchos Lashon Hara. And he wrote a haskama, he wrote a letter recommending that book that I just mentioned. And he actually is a little bit warning in the haskama that maybe he doesn't agree with everything. And he indicated there that the checklist of the Chafetz Chaim, the questions that you have to address, he doesn't think you necessarily have to answer all of them perfectly before going forward. These are good faith attempts. You have to do the best you can to try to account for all these considerations. But if there's an actual risk and you're the only one who can stop it and you're not able to satisfactorily answer all the questions, you may still have to act anyway. But you do the best you can to try to go through this process to make sure that there isn't any unnecessary harm or compromised judgments in the process. Okay, so far so good? So this was a major area, really one of the most important questions in the laws of Lashon Hara is this issue of Toelis. How do you evaluate when you're not allowed to say something and when you're obligated to say something and where in the middle? And the judgment that's brought to that question is crucial to the laws of Lashon Hara, so much so that you could say that that's kemat, all the laws of Lashon Hara, Betty, and everything else is commentary. Everything else kind of surrounds that question. But there are a few other crucial areas. So to touch upon for a moment something I think we talked about a little bit last week, to expand upon it. So we mentioned last week that there is a perhaps surprising concept in the laws of Lashon Hara that is called ape tlasa. That if something is public, apparently there's no prohibition of Lashon Hara. And we discussed a little bit last week how surprising that is. Presumably, if you're speaking to a crowd, it should be not only also Lashon Hara, it should be worse. It should be significantly worse, exponentially worse. So there are a number of views in the Rishonim how to understand that. Perhaps the most well-known is the view of the Rambam, that the Rambam understood that ape tlasa means not that you're allowed to speak Lashon Hara if you're in public, that wouldn't make any sense, but that if you are part of the audience, if you hear something that was said in front of a significant crowd, so it's going to spread one way or another, with you or without you, you know it's going to spread. So says the Rambam, there's no prohibition for you to speak about it because it's already out there. It's already spreading anyway. Now that's a surprising position for a couple reasons. First of all, just because it's out there, it's going to spread, doesn't mean that you should be allowed to spread it yourself quicker. It's similar to saying that if somebody leaves his door unlocked, so his property is vulnerable, so you can steal the property because someone else is going to steal it anyway, so you may as well steal it first. I wouldn't say that. So why is this any different? So the Rambam already addresses that. The Rambam says that it has to be that you're not trying to actually spread it. You're only discussing it within the circles that already know about it. But if you were actually expanding the circle, that would be a problem. Or accelerating the pace, that also would be a problem. But you could ask a different question, that even though you're not increasing the harm, but what about midos? Isn't this still a negative character trait? Why should you be gossiping? Just because it's out there, just because people already know about it, so what? You're still not supposed to engage in negative discussions and gossipy character traits, so why is that not a problem, according to the Rambam? So that's a good question. And there are some who noted within the Rambam that if you read carefully the way the Rambam presents the laws of Lashon Hara, is the beginning of the seventh parak of Hilchos Deos, so you'd see that he actually goes through defining Lashon Hara twice. And it seems like he's actually addressing two different components. That first, he talks about disparaging people, the ganos is chaver. So that, perhaps, is a reference to the midah, to the character trait of Lashon Hara. But then he goes on as if he's starting over again. And he says, what is Lashon Hara? If he's giving you a new definition now. That is saying something that causes harm to another. And after he says that, then he says, and there's an exception, if something is already in public, apitlasa, so then you're allowed to talk about it as long as you don't spread it beyond the circle. So perhaps what the Rambam means is there's two aspects here. There is the midah, and there is the action of harm. And if you're looking to be negative and gossipy, so then that's prohibited anyway. It doesn't matter whether it's public, private, people know, people don't know. If you're looking to be involved in gossip and to be negative in spirit, then it's prohibited either way. But what Apitlasa is teaching us, this rule of publicity, that comes only in the second category, saying perhaps there's something which you just want to share innocently. It doesn't have any negative aspect to it. You just want to relay information for some neutral reason. But it happens to be that that information could cause problems for the person you're speaking about. So then it's prohibited from a different angle. It's prohibited from the harm angle. And that's where he then says, but if it's already known and you're not adding to the harm, so then it's okay. So essentially the Rambam's telling us we need to satisfy two conditions. First, we need to deal with the midos. It can't be anything that comes from a place of negativity or gossip. And then, even if it doesn't, but it could still be harmful, it's also prohibited. But if you neutralize that because you're not increasing the population that knows about it, so then you're covered on that front also. Make sense? So this could also pop up, this whole framework, in a few other areas of Hilchos Lashon Hara, just to mention one or two others. So there is a question in general. We know there's a prohibition of speaking Lashon Hara. There's also a prohibition of receiving Lashon Hara, what we call Kabbalah's Lashon Hara. And the truth is, it's hard to define what Kabbalah's Lashon Hara means, because Kabbalah sounds like, not mysticism here, but Kabbalah meaning receiving. So receiving is also a passive act. So what does it mean not to be Makabal Lashon Hara? We spoke about this a little bit last week in our internet discussion. But what does it mean practically not to be Makabal? So if the situation was that whenever this came up, somebody would come to you and say, hi, good afternoon, I'm interested in telling you some Lashon Hara right now. Would you like to receive or reject? So then you'll push the reject button and you won't be Makabal Lashon Hara. But it happens like that less than 50% of the time, right? Usually you're ready in a conversation and you hear something that's negative. So what does it mean not to be Makabal? So the Chafetz Chaim writes that Kabbalah's Lashon Hara means that even after you've heard it, you shouldn't believe it. You shouldn't accept it as true. And others disagreed. Others said that you can't control what you believe or not. That's also an automatic passive act. And if somebody you trust tells you something credible about somebody else, you're going to believe it, whether you want to or not. And HaTorah lo nitna l'malachei hasharis, the Torah wasn't given to angels, it was given to human beings who can't really control this. So therefore, it says Rav Moshe Sternbuch and others, it must be that the prohibition of being makabel lashon hara, what does that mean? It means that you shouldn't treat the person differently because of what you heard. unless it's necessary for protection. But assuming it's not relevant to anyone's protection, you shouldn't treat the person in a different way because of this negative information. The fact that in your heart of hearts you believe it, okay, so that we can't do anything about. But as long as you don't treat people differently, that's what the prohibition is. So this also seems to trace back to the same two possibilities, that perhaps the Chafetz Chaim understood here that Lashon Hara is focused on midos, on character, and therefore the assault on character and the demeaning of your personality happens both when you share the information and when you get a geshmak, when you feel juicy and you hear this Lashon Hara that's interesting to you, so that's the other half of it. So Kabbalah's Lashon Hara means don't even participate intellectually. Don't even listen to the Lashon Hara and take it with seriousness. While Rish Darbach and others are saying that Lashon Hara is really about the harm that comes to the person because he's being spoken about. So what's your job? Your job is stop that harm by not acting on it. But whether you believe it or not, that's not our concern. As long as you don't act on it, so that's enough to stop the harm. So this was a significant debate that also seems to revolve around these two possibilities. I would think the truth is really somewhere in the middle. That, yes, it's true that believing is often an automatic, instinctive process, but it's still not true that we have no control over it. We do have some ability to impact what we believe, and I think we mentioned maybe even last week, the Beni Yonah's interpretation that when the Torah says, according to the Gemara Pesachim, the source for the prohibition of Lashon Hara in the receiving role is Lo Sisa Shema Shav, you should not accept a false report. And Beni Yonah asks, if you know it's false, then why would you accept it? Why do you need the Torah to tell you not to accept the false report? And we have to interpret it to mean, do not accept as true something that might be false. In other words, you should reserve judgment when you don't know that something is actually completely true. And we do have that ability to impose some kind of restraint on our belief process. It's not the same control as we have in other areas of life. If I'm told, don't pick up that tissue box, I can decide not to pick it up. But tell me not to believe something, it may take more effort to fight against the instinct to believe it, but it's not impossible. It's not completely out of the realm of control. So presumably the truth here is, again, somewhere in the middle, that yes, there's a difference in being told not to accept something as true. That's different than being told don't lift up the tissue box. But it's also not the case that it's completely outside of our intellectual impact. And that's presumably what the Chafetz Chaim is addressing. So just to quickly mention one or two other points. So there is, let me ask you the following question. So let's say I were to say, here we're talking about Lashon Hara and its impact. So it happens to be, I know a guy, his name is Yeshua Moshe Goldenschwartz, who is a terrible Baal Lashon Hara, spoke a lot of Lashon Hara throughout his life, and really had a miserable existence because of it. And it's important to learn from that tale, from that cautionary tale, to recognize just how bad Lashon Hara is. So is it permissible for me to say that? I made that guy up, right? He's not a real guy. But had that been a real person, so would that be okay to say, or is that also Lashon Hara? Oh, so that's the question. So it sounds like it could be Toelis, but it really goes back a little bit to our initial question of how do you establish Toelis, because this person is not dangerous anymore. He's had his miserable existence, and now he's just trying to lay low. So I'm not warning you about his harmful nature. I'm just trying to use him as a Musar message. So it is purposeful, but it's not a little Samar al-Dam Reacha kind of purposeful. He's not a predator. So that may also revolve around how we understand it. That if we say that Lashon Hara is about Midos, so then I can say, listen, this isn't gossip. This is for an important educational message. But if it's about not harming someone, I am harming him. This person is just trying to lay low now, and I'm talking about how terrible he used to be. So I am harming him. And he's not a predator. So then if it's all about that, then maybe it's not okay. So keep that question in mind for a second. Let me ask you another question. There's another issue that the poskim were not sure about, even though Klal Yisrael already paskined on this issue. Klal Yisrael has decided on this question, but the poskim are still debating it. And that is it permissible to say Lashon Hara if you leave out the name of the person? Now, we'll assume here that you're successfully concealing their identity, which may be a big assumption. That's also a crucial message. Very often, you may leave out a name and you think you are concealing their identity, but it's not so effective a job, and the people can figure out who you're talking about, so that doesn't help anything. But let's say you actually can successfully conceal the identity of who you're talking about. Is that okay? So Klal Yisrael already decided on this one. They're already quite sure, everyone's quite sure that if I leave out the name, it's okay, it's not Lashon Hara. But the poskim weren't so sure. So what's the issue there? So there, presumably, it also revolves around the same question. That if the issue is that I'm not supposed to harm people through speech, so then you could say, well, I'm not harming anybody. Names have been left out to protect the guilty, so there's not going to be any harm. Should be okay. But if the issue is midos, maybe it's not so okay. There are gossip columns that are written like that. What famous celebrity did such and such? Or what famous actor was caught doing whatever? It's still a geschmack of the gossip to share the salacious information, even if you don't identify who you're talking about. So it may, again, revolve around the same question. Is it a midos issue, or is it a harm issue? Now, if we combine the two, let's say I were to tell you that there's a person who spoke a lot of Lashon Hara and his life was terrible. I won't tell you his name, but I just want you to understand the story as a cautionary tale. So is that okay? So presumably there you're covered in both senses, because the midos issue is not there because you're doing it purposefully, and you're not harming anyone because you are leaving out the name. So maybe that combines elements of both, and maybe that's an example of where you would be clear no matter what. So what do we see? What do we see considering all these points? We see that when it comes to Hilchos Lashon Hara and the concept of Lashon Hara, we have a midos component and we have a action component, the reality of hurting someone through speaking about them. And presumably they both exist and they synergize with each other. They strengthen each other. The more you talk about somebody negatively, the more harm you cause, and the more you strengthen your own attributes of negativity. And the more of an attribute of negativity you have, the more harmful you're going to end up being in practice. And the relationship between these two is highly significant. There happens to be a specific mitzvah in the Torah, at least according to the Ramban. So we mentioned the story of Miriam. Miriam and her Lashon Hara against Moshe and her punishment. The Torah later on in Sefer Dvarim tells us to remember the story of Miriam. And according to the Ramban, in his commentary to Chumash and in his glosses on the Ramban writes, that's a real mitzvah min HaTorah. That's one of the 613 mitzvahs to remember what happened to Miriam. So why? Why do we need a mitzvah specifically to remember the story? So the Ramban says, to keep us away from Lashon Hara. We shouldn't speak badly about others. Okay, we get that, but why is Lashon Hara so lucky? We have a lot of prohibitions in the Torah, and it's not the case that every time there's a prohibition in the Torah, there's also a story about somebody who violated it and got punished, and then an extra mitzvah to remember the story. So why is Lashon Hara so lucky? Why does it get this extra mitzvah? There was a suggestion, the Mashgiach of the Sabarki Yeshiva, Rabbi Isaac Sher, interpreted this based on the fact that Lashon Hara is a uniquely dangerous kind of issue. If I'm looking to keep kosher, so then when I'm hungry, I'll check the ingredients, I'll check the hashgacha, and I'll make sure I'm keeping kosher. Lashon Hara doesn't work that way. The Rambam writes, as he notes, the Rambam writes that if I say something nasty about someone, that's Lashon Hara. If I say something nice and it comes out nasty, that's Avak Lashon Hara. So you could say, well, what do you want from me? The whole point was I'm trying to be nice. I didn't know it was going to come out nasty. So how could you say I'm violating any prohibition if I say something nice that comes out nasty? The whole point was I thought it was nice. Says Rav Sher, what do you see from here? You see that Lashon Hara is uniquely complicated. it's not something you can just wait until the moment and address it and assume it's going to work out. If that's your plan, you're going to end up hurting people. And built in to the halachos of Lashon Hara is that there's a midah that's there, and there's a reality that goes beyond what we can figure out in the moment. And the only way you're going to be successful in avoiding Lashon Hara is if you work on this in advance. And how do you know? Where do you see this? Look at Miriam. Miriam was a tzaddikas, one of the greatest people in the history of the Jewish people. And as the Rambam does describe in his Mishneh Torah in Hilchos Taras, he says here, Miriam was a holy, righteous person and cared deeply about the person she was talking about. She raised him. And she only meant well. She was trying to help. And still, Miriam ends up tripping over Lashon Hara. So what hope do the rest of us have? What hope do we have to avoid Lashon Hara if even the great Miriam couldn't? The answer is, we have Miriam. We have that story. We have this episode in the Torah. And a mitzvah to remember that story, that tells us that we have to start working in advance. Because if we leave it to the moment, even Miriam couldn't prevail in such a situation. And our only hope is to learn from that story. So that's where perhaps there's a message for the Meraglim. We know there is a halacha, one of my favorite halachas to talk about. We have a obligation Friday night when we make Kiddush. We have to cover the challahs when we make Kiddush. So why do we cover the challahs? So in the Talmud Yerushalmi and the Tur, of a number of suggestions. The most interesting of the suggestions, we cover the challah because we don't want to embarrass the challah, that we could have actually made Kiddush on challah. We choose instead to make Kiddush on the wine, so we cover up the challah. It shouldn't see that we're choosing to make Kiddush and passing him over to make Kiddush on the wine instead. So that's a very baffling idea, that we're so concerned about the embarrassment of the challah. Tell you a secret, the challah will get over it, and what you do to the challah 5 minutes later is much worse. So the idea that we're so concerned about hurting the challah's feelings is a little hard to internalize, except that's really the point, that the halach is telling us we have to practice. We have to work on developing that sensitivity in advance, because if we wait until the moment, if we're concerned we shouldn't embarrass a human being, and we think we'll just decide in the moment if what we're doing is going to be hurtful or not, it's not going to work. We're going to end up hurting people. The only way you can hope to be successful in not inflicting emotional pain on others is if you work on that in advance. If you work to internalize that message, that sensitivity, through practice, through thinking out situations and questioning how you would act, that's the only way you have a hope. So that's the message of Miriam. It's why the Torah tells us to remember the story of Miriam so that we should recognize it takes that kind of effort. So perhaps that's what Rashi is telling us in the beginning of Parsha Shlach that we began with. Rashi says, why is the Torah giving us the story of the spies right after the story of Miriam? Because the spies should have learned a lesson from Miriam. And we asked, what do you mean? It's a Kal Vachomer? What the spies did was worse? Isn't Miriam's Avera worse, like the Talmud says? So what we could see here is, yes, indeed, Rashi is not saying it's a Kal Vachomer. Rashi is saying the message of Miriam is that this is such a complex area that your only hope is to start practicing, is to start covering your challahs, is to start working on developing that sensitivity. And how did the Meraglim respond? Right away, after seeing how Miriam the Tzaddikas gets in trouble with Lashon Hara, their first step is to go and indulge that negativity and speak about the land of Israel. That's a complete betrayal of the message. And that's what Rashi is telling us, Rashayim halalu hayilahem likach musar. They should have learnt the lesson. They should have gotten the point that this is very tricky and that their only hope is to start cultivating a positive, fair, an objective way of seeing things. And then there's a hope. But right away, go and indulge that negativity. That was completely missing the point. And that's what leaves us in the situation we're in this week. That's what leaves us with a Tisha B'Av on the calendar, because we still haven't fixed that midah of the Meraglim that failed to learn that lesson in Miriam. So Miriam reminds us that even the greatest among us have to work hard at uprooting any kind of internal negativity, any kind of a judgment of others that is unfair. And as some point out, that specifically was with Miriam's Avera. It wasn't even about anything factual that she was saying. It was about her assessment of Moshe's personal life and saying, why is he any different than us? It was a failure to be dam l'chavschus, to judge with generosity and objectivity. And that's what's upon us still to correct and to recognize just how deep that goes. So we still have a few days. And maybe we can still get that message. Unfortunately, we have days, but we have no more minutes, because the greatest way to cause harm through speech is to talk so long you delay ma'ariv. So I'm going to stop here. But I thank you all so much for joining me these past few weeks. And hope to see you again when we no longer have to cry and mourn, but that instead we'll be able to take these lessons and use them to turn it all around, and we should have no more suffering and no more fasting. Wish you a meaningful Tisha B'Av, however it plays out, on the 10th of Av, and we should all know only good things.
Thank you very much.